Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt. Good morning.
Good morning. You're looking spiffy today, though.
Well, I'm sorry. I've delayed our taping time. I actually am going to be on MSNBC shortly after I talk to you. And since on a typical day, I don't leave the house, I don't want that to be evident when I go on air. So I don't have like a role, you know. Other people, they can kind of get themselves dolled up in like 5 minutes. So they do it every day, and I have to kind of remember what is it I do again? What do I wash again? What do I wear again?
It's and, weird, you know. I used to wear a tie when I worked at the Leadership Institute for 4 years. I used to wear a tie to work every day. I can't imagine. The only time I ever wear a tie now is if somebody dies or I'm going on TV.
and so I made my problem a little worse this morning. This is my third time on in like a month or so. And I'm sure nobody cares. I'm sure it's all in my head and nobody cares at all. But I didn't want to be the guy that always wears the same outfit.
Yeah.
I
do that for this show. Because we only tape once a week, it's possible that you could wear the same thing every week, just Thursday or every Wednesday.
I don't worry about that for this show. But I actually have done some. I used to be in professional PR. I've done some media training, and I know. I mean, I'm kind of old school. Old school media training is blue shirt, red tie, primary colors, solid colors. No patterns, no stripes, nothing that distracts from the eye, and that's not the norm now on cable TV. There's a whole lot of busy stuff going on with what people wear on cable TV nowadays. And
well, some of it too is the technology has advanced, and so you don't have the blurring effect that you used to have so much if you wore a tie that had. Now that people have high definition TV, I think that some of those problems with, you know, I forget what the technical term for it is, but have been alleviated.
Right, and that's that shows how old I am. I'm not up on the impact of HDTV. So I thought I'd wear something a little bit different, and then I realized, okay, if I'm going to wear a purple shirt, what tie do I wear? What goes with the purple shirt? I have no idea, and that's what slowed me down. I'm sure that is
When I used to do a lot of TV years ago, there was a time when I was, you know, many, many times a week I was on. I mean, several times a day, in fact. And I had all of these shirt-tie combos, which now are essentially irrelevant. I still have, like, hundreds of neckties. But, no, it's right. You don't think about this as a guy. You know, they're only – now, in a way, we have it easy because all you need is sort of a blue blazer and a couple of shirts and ties. But – If you want to take it up a notch, there's not a lot of ways that a guy can accessorize. I mean, you could do the whole handkerchief in the pocket thing, but really it comes down to neckties and shirt combinations. And you want to be a little daring and have a little flair, but you can go too far with that as well. So I feel your pain, Bill, and I'm sure you'll do great if I
made scandalous choices in the 11 o'clock hour at MSNBC.
You may be on Fishbowl DC, maybe mocking you.
I probably should do something mockable to draw attention to myself. I'm trying too hard to do the right thing. I should be doing the wrong thing.
It's a theory. You know, I always thought like having a prop would be great, like the bow tie thing.
Not a carrot top kind of prop. I shouldn't have be a ventriloquist at MSNBC.
Well, during the Romney era, I was thinking about going with a monocle. I thought that could be my look. But no, you know, Tom Wolfe had like the white suits. You know, Mark Twain, Colonel Sanders. I mean, there is a look, and I don't have. I mean, I think my distinguishing thing may be the gray and the temple. which will last as long as the rest of my hair doesn't turn gray. But, you know, I think it's good to have a little bit of a gimmick to help your brand. Now, it's too late for me to do it now. It would be derpy.
Never too late for a gimmick.
As the kids say. But, no, I mean, you know, there's, you know, Crystal Liz has the glasses, Rachel Maddow has the glasses. I mean, you know, it's nice to have something. So, you know, if you have any ideas, put them in the comments.
Well, let's get cracking since I have a bit of limited time. I know the news just broke today, so I don't know if either one of us has a lot to say about it, but Obama is going to announce this afternoon. He's appointing Susan Rice to be National Security Advisor, Samantha Power to UN Ambassador. These two have been kind of with Obama from the beginning, arguably major influences towards his sort of aggressive humanitarian foreign policy, a willingness to use force to achieve humanitarian goals. Samantha Power, known for her anti-genocide writings. Susan Rice had a big role in organizing the coalition to oust Gaddafi in Libya. But, of course, everyone knows she got denied the Secretary of State nomination because of all the furious pushback from the right about her role talking about Benghazi on TV.
Right.
I mean, so the obvious point is that Republicans are mad and livid and incredulous that Obama would do this. How can you nominate someone who has such horrible judgment to such a sensitive position, yada, yada, yada. And the left is obviously going to be happy. Anytime Obama does something to poke the right in the eye, they love it. And that doesn't involve a confirmation. So there's nothing can stop him from doing it. But I guess my question to you is... Beyond the huffing and puffing that will happen in this 24-hour window, what do you think is the actual practical implication of doing it? Whether it's foreign policy, does it change Obama's foreign policy? Does it or signal the direction of his foreign policy? Or is there some impact as far domestically? Does it actually change his relationship with Republicans in Congress, or is that already so abysmal that what's the difference?
So I guess my first point is, I wonder if, I mean, was Tom Donilon scheduled to leave? It sort of feels like maybe he was like encouraged to leave so that Susan Rice could have like a consolation prize, because it does appear that she was, when she was passed over, it's really maybe not fair to her that she was given these bogus talking points. And so I think that a lot of people, conservatives who went after Susan Rice, and let's be honest, I mean, okay, from my standpoint at least, Bill, and I think from a lot of other people's standpoint, she did go on 5 or 6 Sunday shows and mislead the public. But it appears that she may have been misled as well. And so I guess number one, I wonder if this is some sort of a consolation prize, give her this spot. It's not this job that she wanted, but give her this spot to sort of as a consolation. The other thing that I think about in terms of is it Susan Powers?
Samantha Power.
I'm sorry, Susan Rice, Samantha Power. At least I didn't say Kirsten and really conflate things. Now, in terms of her, my you mentioned her writing about genocide. I think at one point somebody said she called Hillary Clinton a monster.
She's long apologized for that.
Well, I think the thing that we have, right now, Syria is at the top of mind, the civil war in Syria, and you have essentially a situation where you have a dictatorship that is in a client state of Iran, but the rebels are Islamists, and there's really no good solution here. And I guess the question that I would have with any foreign policy change would be, how might it impact the administration's decisions in terms of Syria? Because, Bill, more and more, you remember you joked a few weeks ago about how I should have a bumper sticker that says, "I'm already against the next war." More and more, and we saw Laura Ingraham go on Fox News Sunday and say America should stay out of this. And more, Bill, I'm thinking that despite what John McCain may say, that we should support the revolutionaries, it seems to me like a really bad situation. And I don't see any good alternatives, no matter what happens. So I'll throw it back to you. do either of these, you know, decisions, do they change how we view, how the administration views or acts in Syria?
I mean, my personal take is I don't know if it changes anything. I mean, I still think Obama's the guy at the top who's going to make the call. And I think this is more evidence that Susan Rice was never on the outs with him, that her counsel was always very influential with him. Because she was still U.N. ambassador this whole time. I mean, she wasn't fired. She's always been in the national security foreign policy inner circle. And she's been at Obama's side here from the beginning. So I don't think it's going to – I don't think the nomination itself portends a shift. My sense of things, again, this is from an outsider. You know, I can't I'm not a fly on the wall in what's being discussed right now. I think he's had a philosophy that is, you know, pro-democracy, pro-human rights. Let's restore America's moral authority in this part of the world. Let's try to resolve festering problems that undercut our ability to employ soft power in the region. And if there are obstacles in our way that military force can resolve effectively, and by that meaning can you get a real bona fide international coalition around it so it's not being seen as, you know, an imperialist project, then you do it. If you can't get that coalition, then you don't do it. And, you know, he was very willing to do it in Libya if he could get UN backing, but he made pretty clear that if he didn't get the UN backing, then he wasn't going to do it. You know, it wasn't that I'm going to do it's hell or high water. And Syria obviously is a much more complicated and fraught situation, partly for what you talk about, that, you know, it's not a clear good guy, bad guy deal. Because there's, I wouldn't say all the rebels are Islamists, but there's obviously elements of that there. So you don't want to swap one enemy for another enemy. And you don't want to swap one undemocratic former government for another undemocratic former government. I think they're obviously treading very carefully and not being rushed into it by those saying, this is bad, you have to do something. And Obama said, I don't have to do something. I'll do something if it's going to work. I'm not going to do it if it's just going to mean endless war. I expect, they seem to be inching towards it, some kind of intervention, but I think they're doing it very carefully and deliberately with the eye towards not doing something that's going to mean leading, you know, chin first. And Susan Rice and Samantha Power are both people who have been willing to use military force and advocate for military force when they think it is morally justified. So I don't see a shift here, but I see people who are strong advocates for a view that Obama already holds.
It's a really bad situation. As you know, Russia's involved in supporting Assad and the aforementioned Iran. It seems likely, I think, that the rebels, if there were to be, if Assad were ousted, I mean, it seems very likely to me that Islamists would take control. It's just a very bad situation. And it does make you wonder, as much as I am not a fan of Obama, what if John McCain had won, or even Mitt Romney? You do have to wonder how America might be responding differently to Syria. I mean, I think it was a huge mistake for Obama to talk about a red line and then to sort of back away from it. That sends a signal of weakness. But having said that, I mean, as you said, it's a lose-lose proposition, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't see any benefit. I don't see that a drop of American blood ought to be spilled, regardless, you know, to ensure one outcome or the other, as if we could do that anyway at this point.
Well, okay, if you phrase it as the choice between a bloody dictator and, you know, Islamic terrorists, and I put a bit of words in your mouth there, so I don't mean to do that.
No, it's not. You're not really out of bounds as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. All right. But if that's the choice, then yeah, it's not worth American blood, absolutely. And I think Obama is very reluctant to, one, get into a proxy war with Russia. He doesn't want to be on the opposite side of Russia on this. and relaunch a Cold War, and he doesn't want to hand the government over to people who are just as bloodthirsty as the people in charge. But I think the Egypt outcome was, I know some conservatives don't like the Egypt outcome because a Muslim Brotherhood candidate is now president. But
right.
that was a small d democratic outcome, and you have not seen Egypt launch terrorist strikes after that. I mean that is the example so far of what you want to see out of this kind of it might be an Islamic flavored democracy, but if it's still democracy and it's not resulting in bloodshed, that's good. So I think if that's the outcome in Syria, I think Obama will be very happy. I think there's some hesitancy that it's going to be like that, and therefore they're treading very carefully with it. But if your framework is accurate.
For conservatives, though, I mean, I would say for conservatives, this is totally different than Egypt, because, I mean, Mubarak was for all of his faults, I mean, we agree he was a dictator and did some very horrible things, but he was, pro-American, pro-Israel. He was a force of stability in the region. I would argue that there's a much better case of nominally backing Mubarak than Assad. So I think that, in other words, I feel like this is there's Gene Kirkpatrick's dictators and double standards. And I think there are occasions when America certainly should support rebels to topple regimes, either rhetorically or actually in terms of no-fly zones or whatever. And then I think there are instances where we should at least hope that the dictator who's pro-American stays in charge rather than have Islamists take control. In this instance, it's just, to me, a lose-lose. I don't see any good outcome. But that's just me. I'm certainly not an expert in the region. But I guess it is worth wondering how administration changes might change administration policies in Syria.
Well, just to quickly tie up the discussion and we can shift to the next thing. I mean, I do think this kind of double nomination is evidence that foreign policy is very much on Obama's mind in his second term, which is not an unusual thing for a second term president, because foreign policy is an area that doesn't require a lot of congressional cooperation, generally speaking. I think Syria is on his mind. I think Iran is on his mind. I think he's meeting with China this week. I mean, there are big, major foreign policy issues yet to deal with, and Obama's not tossing off to some functionary. He's putting in people who's been close with the whole time, because I think he cares very intently what his foreign policy legacy is going to be.
What's also interesting, we should probably just at least acknowledge, I mean, here, two women, which there was a time not that long ago around, during the re-election, when it was pointed out that Obama, despite all the talk about the war on women, that there weren't as many women in high-level positions as you might expect in his administration. So I think it's worth noting.
Well, I just concur there. I mean, people were sort of judging it based on cabinet positions only, and even at that point, a partial tally of cabinet positions, and that doesn't really tell you who are the people he is relying on for his policy. National Security Advisor is not a cabinet position, but it's a critical position that Obama relies on. The White House Counsel is a hugely important position. It covers a range of issues, and that's a woman right now in that position. One cabinet position that's a holdover is Kathleen Sebelius at HHS. She is the single top person executing one of Obama's major domestic legacies, Obamacare. So, you can do tallies and come up with, there should have been more here or more there. And I'm not saying those are irrelevant arguments to make, but there's also a qualitative argument to make here. There are some very critical people in Obama's inner circle that are clearly being picked regardless of their gender or their racial background.
Well, I hope you appreciate that I'm outside my wheelhouse here to help prep you. But be careful. That could come up on your TV hit. That
like I appreciate you giving me some sparring practice. So the other big political story this week is Chris Christie's decision to go for a October special election to fill the seat of the deceased Frank Lautenberg. I appreciate you, Matt, you properly correcting me on Twitter because I misinterpreted what
he did. Well, it was confusing. It was a little confusing, in fairness.
Well, I just didn't watch the whole press conference. So he starts off by saying, you know, there has to be somebody elected here, elected, and I just assumed that meant he wasn't going to appoint anybody. He was just going to leave the seat open until the election was done, and it came out later in the press conference.
Yeah, I think it was in response to a question even, maybe.
Right.
Or it certainly wasn't at the top. At some point, he sort of, as an aside, said, and I will be appointing somebody.
Right, which is sort of crazy to me, and I wrote a little piece about this, because everyone's now going into political conspiracy theories, why October and not November? Is he afraid of Cory Booker? This means that he's going to spend $24 million, so he's going to win re-election with, 60% of the vote, not 70% of the vote. And to me, maybe he is thinking that way. I just don't think that stuff's going to matter very much come a year from now. But the interim pick, this is going to be senator starting in a week or two through October. We're going to have votes in the Senate on immigration, at least, maybe on background checks again, probably on these new circuit court appeal judges, and a Consumer Finance Protection Bureau nomination, which Republicans are threatening to filibuster again. And I would not be surprised at all to see one or two Supreme Court retirements over the summer that could lead to Supreme Court votes in the Senate come September 2. And you have the government spending authority expiring September 30th. Debt limit might actually get reached around that time. So you might have the big budget battle right before the special election that Christie's appointment is going to be in the middle of.
Did you write about this? Did you write about that? What you just?
I just did late last night. It went up around midnight.
I need the link to that because that's a smart point.
And so just to finish that off.
Yeah.
Christie gave a speech in January in Washington to the Jersey Chamber of Commerce, lambasting Washington. This town needs a dose of bipartisanship. We need to get things done. The American people have lost trust in these institutions. Okay, buddy, put up or shut up. This is your chance to put your stamp on this institution. Are you going to pick somebody? I mean, I don't think he's going to pick a Democrat. I think he's going to pick a Republican. But you're going to pick a Republican that actually tries to work across the aisle and get some of these things done. Or are you going to pick somebody who's going to filibuster like everybody else has been doing? And this is your call, and I think that might have much more resonance going into 2014, 2016 than what date is the special election.
Well, look, I think that's a very astute and sagacious point, though.
Thank you.
And one that is not, as we try to read the tea leaves and sort of divine political motives, I think you've hit on some substance. So let me get down in the dirt a little bit.
All right.
Because I think you're totally right. But having said that, I think that there probably is a political calculation as well. I mean, look, Christie could hold off rather than spending tens of millions of dollars to hold a special election in October. He could just have it be in November when he's up on the ballot. By the way, a lot of people believe that he could have held off till 2014. And so what he could have done is appointed someone like the younger Tom Keene, who could have served for a year or so, raised a lot of money, been a moderate Republican, and had a chance in 2014, being the incumbent, to be reelected. Christie opted not to do that. And I think some national Republicans at least felt like that would have been what they would have preferred. So Christie instead decided to do it in 2013. But even allowing that, he could have done it in November, and it would have saved the taxpayers a lot of money. And there are theories some noble, some less noble, for why he did that. Well, Christie's, you know, saying the citizens of New Jersey deserve an elected representative as soon as possible. We're going to do this as soon as possible. So he's sort of, you know, taking that moral high ground, which I think is a little bit absurd. The good people of New Jersey could wait an extra month if it meant saving a lot of money.
And I think there's a sense that, like, if you're appointed, you're somehow illegitimate. Chris Christie is a statewide elected official that presumably has a mandate from the people of his state. And if he has legal authority to say, I think this is a good person to be in the Senate, that's not undemocratic. That's, you know, obviously you wouldn't want to have the entire Senate be appointees, but we have provisions in place to deal with vacancies, and that's not some sort of Politburo Soviet-style way to fill a vacancy. So it's still
that's a valid point. I agree with you substantively, but I do think that if Christie had, you know, sort of maximized his power, there would have been some in New Jersey and some liberals who would have, you know, accused him of playing politics and of depriving the citizens of New Jersey the right to an elected senator. That rhetoric would have come out. Now, who cares? I mean, but Christie obviously cares. But the other point is that two other points. One, there's a legitimate point where Republicans should be thankful that there's going to be a special election that'll be held not the same day as Christie's reelect, because Christie, when he's reelected, so, you know, the general election, there'll be state senators and state reps on the ballot as well. And if Cory Booker were running in this special election for Senate, he would presumably drag a lot of the liberal base to the polls who may vote against the Republican state Senate candidates. So Christie, in a sense, is helping the Republican down ticket by keeping Cory Booker off the ballot in the general election. But he's also helping himself. And here's where I think Jennifer Rubin, who I think it's safe to say is a fan of Christie, at the Washington Post said, you know, this is what his entire theory for 2016, to the extent that he has a theory for 2016, is win as big as possible reelection. That he can then go to the Republican voters and say, I'm a Republican who got 60-whatever% of the vote in a blue state like New Jersey, therefore I can do it again nationally. So she says, you know, she's actually saying this is a strategy, and it's calculated, and maybe it's not even a bad strategy.
It's not a bad strategy, but I think he's going to win big either way. I mean, maybe it'd be a little less big if Booker was on the ballot, but this is not a close race that he's in. So, I mean, it may be that he's thinking this way. I think that's kind of silly thinking. That's very small ball thinking. And I think if he appointed someone for the full year and a half, yeah, people would say things that you are being undemocratic and you're not doing what Frank Lauenberg would have done, what the voters wanted, yada, yada, yada. The proof would be in the pudding. The proof would be, who did you appoint, and how did that person perform? And that person performed in a way that was reflective of New Jersey's more, you know, bluish tint, moderate sensibilities, then I don't think you'd get called out for that. If you pick someone who was, you know, a total right winger, then say, well, that's the real Christie. And, you know, obviously the right of the Republican Party would like it and other people wouldn't. But that's, I think the person of the appointee in either scenario, what's actually going to happen now for a 4-month period, or it would have happened over a 14-month period, I think that's going to be the biggest test for him. And either of these scenarios, I should add, you know, we're not talking about the 60th vote. You know, we're not talking about things that are making or breaking based on this one vote. But I do think, at least there's a chance, that there would be an impact if you picked a Republican who is openly talking about bipartisanship and openly voting. You know, people talk about it, to actually cast the votes to do it. Would that have some larger impact? Would that bring other Republicans along? Would that let folks break away from the Tea Party more and say, look, I'm sick and tired of all this posturing. I did come to this town to get things done. This person that Christie picked is getting a lot of good play for making this case, I feel more comfortable doing it now. So you get a 70 vote immigration bill, you end the obstruction on some of these nominees. Would that accelerate the quote unquote fever breaking? Now I'm not saying that it would definitely happen that way, but if you're Chris Christie and you have said that's what you want to have happen, this is your chance to give it a shot.
Yeah, and I think it's very likely that Christie will pick somebody who is perceived as being, you know, a moderate Republican, but also somebody who's serious and competent. I don't think you can expect him to pick any sort of bomb throwers.
He's sort of a moderate-ish bomb thrower, so, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that Christie, I think that this will be a calculated pick, and I think he's, you know, he wants to buttress, he wants to be very popular in New Jersey, and then he will take that popularity as his prime selling point, if he runs for president.
Now, this is all playing into the backdrop of, you know, where does the Republican Party go from here? Should they be a partner in power with Obama to show they're a changed party, or do they need to dig in their heels and block Obama as much as possible to show the error of Obama's ways? And we now have this other kind of more inside the beltway or inside the Amtrak corridor or maybe the New York to Macon, Georgia corridor between Josh Barrow, who just jumped from Bloomberg to Business Insider and has had a couple of magazine profiles lately as the future of a more intellectual conservatism, although articles written by people who are not conservative, and Eric Erickson, who, as we all know, is a great lover of working women like your wife. And also is mocking.
I love powerful women. Nothing.
You love women who are the breadwinners, right?
I think if given the choice, if you're a dude and you can marry a high earner, by all means.
So according to Eric Erickson, you are the downfall of American society. You are ripping the fabric.
I may be one of the how did he describe? It wasn't like beta male, but it was something emo. It was like
you're emo lefty.
I guess so. No, I prefer to think that I am secure enough in my manhood that nothing better than a really tough. I like women who are. I like, you know. You guys have seen Erin. She's the whole package. Mom, wife, you know, high earner, you know, you name it.
I digress. So, but Eric Erickson is I guess Josh Barrow said publicly that he actually doesn't consider himself a conservative, more of a neoliberal or a moderate. And Eric Erickson is now crowing. This proves we should not. Why are we talking about Barrow as some sort of conservative reformer? He's not even a conservative.
I think that's valid, Bill. I mean, look, it doesn't mean that he can't offer criticism, and you have offered, I think, sincere criticism or sincere advice as a liberal to conservative. It doesn't mean that Barrow can't offer it, but I think there is a problem when the media, you know, sort of elevates somebody and defines them as a conservative reformer, and they don't call themselves a conservative. Because, number one, if you're a conservative who wants to reform conservatism, then presumably you want to preserve the, you know, fundamental tenets of conservatism. And if you're not a conservative and you want to conserve it, you may have no loyalty to some of those fundamental tenets.
I think
words are important, and it doesn't mean that the Barrow may be very smart and have some good points, but the media should not elevate him and define him and mischaracterize him, frankly.
Now, I don't know enough about Barrow's background and headspace to make a definitive point here, but I do know he did work at a conservative think tank. One of his first jobs out of college was working at a conservative think tank. So I guess I don't totally grasp his ideological trajectory. I also don't totally grasp why I'm supposed to care. I like his writings. He seems like a smart guy. I'm not sure why he's getting this much attention, but perhaps that's just, you know, a bit of petty professional jealousy on my part.
I don't think you should care. I mean, I think that the people who are the most sensitive to this, people like Erickson who have raised it as an issue, are the people who ought to care because, you know, again, I think that, and I've written about this before, you know, the morning after the election, I wrote how, you know, the conservatism needs to modernize, not moderate, or, you know, and so I think that it is important that conservatives have, you know, sort of, we need a 21st century version of conservatism, but we also need to hew to first principles and things that we actually want to conserve within conservatism. And so this is a long discussion and you know, intellectual process that conservatives are going through. But if the person being held up and elevated as the leader or one of the most important conservative, you know, intellectuals, conservative reformers, doesn't define himself as conservative, then it may not be a big deal to the average person, but clearly, you know, he shouldn't be represented that way, as if, you know, and he says he's not. I'll take him at his word. He says he used to be a libertarian, but I guess not anymore either. So, again, smart guy, very well may have valid points about the Republican Party and conservatism, but I think Eric Erickson is also right that, you know, that words matter and the way that we define people and classify them matters, and it's just not appropriate to mischaracterize somebody.
I guess what I don't understand about this whole flap is, I guess the question is, should conservatives be treating Barrow's advice as coming from within the family and coming from someone who wants to see conservatism or the Republican Party succeed? And therefore, that might color how you view the motive of his advice. Whereas it's kind of for me, as you know, Matt, I try to give sincere advice, but obviously my end goal of the world is not to have triumphant conservatism. So you will take what I offer with some grain of salt. I understand that. And I guess with Barrow, I don't totally grasp what he says his end goal is. Does he want Republicans to win? Does he want conservatism to win? I just don't know what he wants. And I also don't know what his concrete ideas are. Now, that just might be my own personal ignorance. Maybe they have been written elsewhere. I mean, I don't read everything that he has written. What I have read has been more critiques of current conservatism as not being up to intellectual snuff. I haven't seen him give some kind of grand unifying vision of the world. This is where I think modern Republicans should go to be debated as being fair advice or disingenuous advice. I mean, does he have some sort of grand idea that he's pushing, that Eric Erickson is pushing back against, or is this all just hypothetical?
No, I think mostly the latter. I mean, I think that if there is an irony involved, which is to say that conservatives will love somebody like a Kirsten Powers, who's a liberal and worked for Bill Clinton, when she says something conservative, conservatives will love her for doing that. But if you're, say, a David Frum, on the other hand, someone who is, you know, nominally a conservative and aligns himself on the right, you don't, you know, you're mistrusted, distrusted. So there is that irony but I think that fundamentally that there are two things at play here. I think that one of the things is that there's three things. One I've already discussed, which is the importance of defining people appropriately and accurately. I think the other thing is, you know, Erickson went on to talk about the D.C.-New York corridor and how that's the problem, that all these reform conservatives are from this geographic area, not real America, the laboratories of democracy. And this is sort of a populist trope, and it's really convenient shorthand if you want to bash people who are sort of like establishment or moderate. Unfortunately, the problem is that, you know, it doesn't really work. That's a very simplistic notion. But I think that there is a cultural thing at play here. It's not geographic, it's cultural. And that Barrow, you know, culturally would probably fit in more with the Ezra Klein's and Dave Weigel's of the world than the Eric Erickson's of the world. And so I think, you know, you could say that that's a silly reason to distrust somebody, but I think there's a certain cosmopolitanism and, you know, more progressive worldview at play there that's important. And I think that there is a sincere willingness of conservatives to do a little navel-gazing and a little soul-searching about the future of conservatism, they're not really excited about people who aren't conservatives but spend a lot of their time criticizing conservatives. It's seen as, you know, the term derp and derpy has become popular in this and this mini scandal, but another you know, Twitter era term, concern trolling, comes to mind. That there's a notion that they're, you know, only talking about what's wrong with conservatism, not because they have a sincere desire to fix it, but and, you know, as a way to bash conservatism. Let me just say, I mean, like, I can appreciate both sides of this. I think I come down on the side of Erickson in the sense that I completely agree with him that, you know, you shouldn't hold up somebody as the quintessential reform conservative if they don't call themselves conservative. At the same time, you know, not all of my views are accepted by, you know, the grassroots of conservatism. I would argue that, you know, being for immigration reform is conservative, but I understand why some people disagree with that. So, and there certainly are people who think I'm a rhino sellout, you know. They would probably assume that, you know, Barrow and I are going to go grab tea after I, you know, publish here. So, it's not that I'm not unsympathetic to Barrow in this case. I think I probably come down a little more on Erickson's side in this specific dispute.
I guess my last question, and then I have to wrap up. I don't understand how someone gets people to care about what they think before they've even thunk it. He hasn't even given his great ideas yet. What happens for attention to get paid this early in one's career? I am personally baffled. I want to know the secrets. Do you understand the secrets?
Number one, I'm not familiar with his entire oeuvre. I'm not a fan of his entire catalog.
his earlier work is better than the new stuff.
As Michael Bolton, as I am with Michael Bolton's entire catalog. So I'm sure, he's been around a few years. I mean, he's young, but he's been around. I'm sure he has put out ideas, some of which Eric Erickson disagrees with in terms of Obamacare and whatnot. But I do think that the buzz is probably overwrought. And so who knows what it is. But look, I think that, you know, if you are somebody who the New Yorker and the New York, if you're a conservative that all the cool kids, the juice box drinkers, the boy banders, you know, whatever you want to call this clique, if you are a conservative that they all love, then a lot of conservatives are going to be skeptical of you. What I've always hoped for is a grudging respect. You know, I don't necessarily want them to say they like Matt Lewis, but it's like he's intellectually honest. If they say that about me, he's a jerk sometimes, but you know he's not a moron and he's intellectually honest. I take that as a win. I think Barrow has gotten this fawning praise from people who are, you know, essentially, you know, secular liberals, and that alone is enough to make people like Erickson and a lot of conservatives say, what's up with this guy? Why is it that they all love him? There must be something wrong. There must be something wrong with him. And by all means, he shouldn't be the arbiter of defining the future of conservatism, at the very least. And in fact, he's gotten this incredible press. And maybe, you know, you've said before that you may have harbored some personal jealousy toward him. I mean, I think that may be a bipartisan thing. I mean, there's a danger to being young and being, you know, getting this press attention. There's sometimes a backlash, and that's not necessarily the most noble reason to dislike somebody or to disagree with them. But it's entirely possible that he may, you know, be getting a little bit of a backlash because of the attention and the sort of fawning praise he's got.
Well, I think we should leave it on that cynical
sour note. All right, we'll go break a leg, man, on TV.
Appreciate it. I'll try to aspire to Matt Lewisian standards.
Don't aim higher than that, by all means.
you get asked back a lot, so I think those are good standards.
Well, you have been as well. So awesome, man. Good talking with you. We'll see all of you next week on the DMZ.